From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and I discussed the decision to retry American student Amanda Knox in Italy and the banking crisis in the Mediterranean island nation of Cyprus.
As the Russians start looking for other places to invest, it might be in northern Cyprus.
And as the world's Christians celebrate Good Friday, Italian language and literature professor Jason Houston joins me from the University of Oklahoma's Center in Arezzo, Italy. He's been following the Catholic Church's transition of power in the Vatican.
Did he know already in 2009 that he was going to resign? What was that act? It's an interesting moment, but he had to know what Dante's judgment was of that act and the danger that it posed for the Church at that time.
What the last voluntary papal resignation in 1294 can teach us about 2013 after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. A lot of international news this week, as usual. Former South African President Nelson Mandela was hospitalized again with a lung infection. We wish him well. The United States actually has been engaging in some practice bombing runs with the B-2 stealth bomber over South Korea. This posturing, of course, does not go unnoticed in North Korea, and some wonder if it's, you know, a message being sent to the North Koreans. In Italy, political gridlock continues 1 month after their national elections. They failed to reach a majority after those elections, and so they're having some difficulty still in developing a ruling coalition. And in terms of global health, we're watching a SARS-like outbreak in Hong Kong, where 11 people thus far have contracted some sort of flu-like virus and have died. But we're going to focus in, Rebecca, on a couple of other international issues. Cyprus, of course, is in the news this week. The banking crisis in Cyprus. Actually, this week, the banks in Cyprus reopened after almost 2 weeks of being shut down after they became insolvent or potentially insolvent. They were weakened by the fact that they had too many investments in Greek companies. And so they could become, I guess, another victim of the Greek financial crisis. So, you know, a lot of outcry in Cyprus, a lot of concern about what happens now. The banks are open, but there are capital controls. People can only withdraw something like $300 or 300 euros a day from their accounts so that they prevent a run on the bank. So what's going on here in Cyprus?
Well, as you said, they did open the banks back up after about 2 weeks, as you mentioned. And luckily, it looks like it was relatively peaceful. There was some expectation that we might see some violence here. Not being able to have access to one's money in the bank is a pretty serious way to try to operate and certainly to do business. So there are a lot of people feeling this. As I said, a lot of tension, but not a lot of violence, thankfully.
There really weren't a lot of people lined up outside the banks. I mean, they understood that there were going to be these controls. Mm-hmm. They had been allowed to get like 100 euro a day or something out of the ATM. So it was mainly older people that didn't have ATM cards or that relied on cash that were lined up outside the banks. But yeah, like you said, not a violent response.
Not the rush on the bank that we expected, although that still is a concern that there will be, if not a rush on a bank, general lack of confidence in banks and that people are not going to return their money to banks. Of course, part of this, the bailout that they received from the European Union or from the so-called Troika, which is the European Commission, the IMF, and the European Central Bank, they're getting this bailout. And as part of that, they have to put up about half of the $13 billion, about $6 billion. And that's going to come from the banks. It's going to come from investments of over 100,000 euros.
So depositors that have over 100,000 euros in a bank in Cyprus, their deposits will be converted, I guess, into bank shares.
Right. They'll become investors, essentially, right. And this will pay off the part of the bailout that the European, the Troika is requiring. It's not necessarily that they'll lose these. They may get them back potentially at some point, but this is what they're calling a Greek haircut, and up to 40% is what's going to happen there. And, you know, it's interesting. I don't think many people were talking about Cyprus a couple of weeks ago. When we think about the European crisis, we thought about, you know, Greece, obviously. Ireland to some extent, Portugal, but not a lot of people were talking about Cyprus. But I think those that were paying attention are not necessarily surprised. Cyprus has had fairly lax tax laws. It's kind of been seen as a tax haven, and a lot of international investment, primarily from Russian interests, which were suspected to not always be entirely legal. For example, Cyprus manages about $25 billion in gross domestic product. On top of that, Russian accounts within the country are $31 billion. So significant investment there. And they're going to be the ones that are feeling the haircut.
Well, so they're the ones that have the bank accounts that are larger than 100,000 euros. It's interesting. There's actually a very large Russian presence in Cyprus. I mean, this is their significant amount of population. It's a small country, small population. And there's a large number of Russian residents living there. There are Russian newspapers. There are Russian radio stations. And the Russians are outraged by this. So if there's any outrage going on in Cyprus, it's among the Russians. But even the Russian government is speaking out about this. And it's interesting to see its connection, perhaps, at least the Russians are suggesting, that there's a kind of a European power play going on in Cyprus, that the troika making these demands on this bailout actually harms Russia, and that that's being done purposefully for political reasons, international political reasons.
Yeah, some old political feelings are coming about. And if the Russians are the ones that are going to lose out, perhaps the ones that are going to win is the northern Cypriots, or those that are influenced by the Turks. If you recall, of course, that Turkey is technically one country, but it is essentially split, with the southern half being within the European Union. They use the euro and they are internationally recognized. But there is a northern part only recognized, northern Cyprus, only recognized by Turkey, and they use the Turkish lira. And their economy is actually doing fairly well. So as the Russians start looking for other places to invest, it might be in northern Cyprus.
Well, definitely something to watch there in Cyprus. Well, one of the other international news stories this week, while a lot of attention in the United States was on the Supreme Court cases here with the concerns about the Defense of Marriage Act, Proposition 8, and issues of same-sex marriage, the Supreme Court in Italy makes the news this week for ordering a retrial in the Amanda Knox case. If you remember last year, 2011, Amanda Knox, who had been accused and convicted of murdering her roommate in 2007, Meredith Kircher. This is the American exchange student, Amanda Knox, that she was released, that her conviction was overturned in 2011, and she left the country, is now back in the United States. And so the question is, what next? There's going to be a retrial. Do we actually think Amanda Knox is going to go back to Italy, face retrial, and be ultimately convicted, or perhaps go back to Italian jail?
What a frustrating story this must be for Amanda Knox, as well as for the family of the girl that was killed. So much uncertainty. The Italian legal system really seems to have failed both of them in this instance. A lot of differences in our own legal system and their legal system to see this acquittal and then this so-called double jeopardy. In this country, if you are acquitted of a crime, certainly of a homicide, then you are free, and you're free to go. And I imagine that's what Amanda Knox was hoping, to have this kind of turnaround on her. And, you know, it's not likely that she's going to return for the trial. I can't imagine that she would do that, or that her lawyers—
That she would do that voluntarily,
right?
Certainly. But the United States will be faced with a decision about whether to extradite
her. If she's convicted, not to go up for trial, she can in trial in absentia.
She will probably be trialed in absentia. Needless to say, this is going to be a long process. The Italian legal system is a very long and drawn-out process. And this case really highlights the difference between their legal system and our legal system. But anyway, something to definitely watch.
It's unlikely that she will be extradited, but this story is long from over.
Well, thank you, Rebecca, so much, as always, for your insight.
Thank you.
If you have a question or a comment for our panel, you can send it to us by email at worldviews@ou.edu. or follow us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU. Coming up, I'll talk with University of Oklahoma Italian Language and Literature Professor Jason Houston. He joins me from OU's Center in Arezzo, Italy. He's been studying Pope Celestine V's resignation in 1294 and how the 700-year-old decision resonates in 2013. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews on KGOU. I'm Suzek Rolat. the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. It's been just over a month since Pope Benedict stepped down and 2 weeks since Argentinian Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio assumed the papacy. Pope Francis celebrates his first Easter Mass as pontiff this weekend, and on this Good Friday, we'll talk with Jason Houston. He's a professor of Italian language and literature at OU, and for the past few months has served as the faculty in residence for the University Center in Arezzo, Italy. He joins us via Skype from Tuscany. Jason Houston, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you, Suzette. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you for joining us all the way from Italy. Some exciting times going on over there. We have recently witnessed the resignation and retirement of Pope Benedict. This was obviously very significant given its historical, this hasn't happened in a long time. 600 years ago, we had a pope resign, Celestine V. But it hasn't happened since then. Can you tell us what's going on here with Pope Benedict's resignation and why is this so historically significant? Why does this not normally happen?
Well, it's a difficult story to tell because the circumstances around the resignation of the previous pope, as you mentioned, Celestine V, in 1294, he resigned and died in 1296, were also very murky. And so too is the case now. Although Benedict XVI, who retired or resigned now about a month ago, explained that it was because of his health that he resigned, no one quite in Italy believes that's the full answer and that there are other forces at play behind that. I don't know, obviously, why he resigned, but the fact that he did resign is revolutionary. There's a reason that it's been 600 years since a pope's resigned, because it really does affect the position of the office of papacy. Popes don't resign, and when they do, it doesn't end well. And in fact, the pope who resigned in 1294 and died in 1296, Celestine V, was imprisoned by the pope who took over after him. And that pope, Boniface VIII, led to the downfall of the papacy and moving it to France, to Avignon, for 100 years, which is the so-called Babylonian captivity. So the last time the papacy was resigned, it ended up in a disaster for the papacy, for the institution of the papacy.
Yeah, because there was a lot of conflict at the time within the church. I mean, does it really sound like it's all that different from what we see today? I mean, there are a lot of people who are very critical of the Catholic Church and in particular the Vatican. So, are we likely to see something similar to that? Or is this really just an issue of Pope Benedict was ill? I mean, he looks very frail. There are all of these reports about scandal and whatnot. But like you said, there's been little to prove that anything is amiss. So can we really compare the two situations?
Well, that's one thing I think I get from living in Italy and living in Europe in general. The fact that history is continually repeating itself and events that happened 600 years ago, which seems so far away in Italy, maybe particularly in Italy, don't seem that far away. And people around here know that, and they know the circumstances, and they know the fact that politics, papal, and secular in Italy are always intermixed. And it isn't by chance that the Pope chose to resign a month before the Italian national elections. Actually, no, a week before the Italian national elections. No one here thought that that was by chance. Equally, back in 1294, when Celestine V resigned, everyone understood that it wasn't because he wanted to go back and be a hermit. They pulled him out of the cave to make him pope. He didn't want to be pope. They literally drug him out of a cave in Umbria and forced him onto the papal throne. But they were done with him, and someone pushed him out. I'm not suggesting that Benedict XVI was pushed out. I don't know, and no one knows, other than Benedict and maybe a few around him. But what I am fairly certain of is that Italians understand or believe that there's more to it than what we know.
So there's something else going on behind the scenes here. I mean, you mentioned that politics in Italy and the church in Italy, that they kind of go hand in hand, that there's this connection. And so the fact that there was some timing going on here would lead everyone to be suspicious, or is it just that, Italians are just suspicious?
Both. It's hard to answer, but here they really think they're onto something, especially the Italians who are more left, center-left, who always see the church as mingling unwelcomely in the affairs of state. And I think that they feel, the people of the Movimento Cinque Stelle, which is the third party, let's say, in Italian politics, that had 30% of the vote this time, an incredible turnout, they feel really vindicated by the fact that even though, as they see it, Benedict played this ultimate card to try to get the citizens to vote center-right, Monti's party. They didn't. And that the Italian citizens continued to move away from that kind of politics towards the new politics of the five-star movement and Beppe Grillo. So there's no separation of church and state here institutionally or intellectually. It's just assumed that these things go hand in hand. And very few people know, I think, outside of Italy, that Italian taxpayers pays for the maintenance of all the cardinals in Rome. They pay the Vatican to be there. And they're very upset about that, especially in this time of economic crisis. So, yes, they suspect too much, I believe, but they're sure something's going on. And that's just the way Italians are.
So speaking of the response then, the reaction of the public 600 years ago compared to the reaction of the public today, I mean, what has been the general response there in Italy?
The reaction 600 years ago of the people, the everyday person in Italy, is, of course, much harder to know because of sources. We just don't know what people were saying. But one important reaction, and one that carries a lot of weight, not only in Italy but around the world, is the fact that Dante Alighieri, the very famous Italian poet who wrote the Divine Comedy, put Celestine V in hell for giving up the papacy, specifically for that fact. Even though Celestine V in 1313 was made a saint by the church, Dante, when he wrote the Inferno in about 1305 to 1310, chose to put Celestine V in hell for the reason, for that exact reason. Because not so much of the fact that he resigned, but because what came after. Because the fact that Boniface was able to take over afterwards and lead the church down this path that, of ruin in his mind. So that response has carried a lot of weight across the generations. And I can't believe that Benedict didn't know that when he resigned. It was interesting. In 2009, Benedict went to the grave of Celestine V. He visited the church where Celestine V was buried. He, at that time, took off the pallium, which is the cord, the wool cord that's invested on the Pope the day he got invested in 2005, and laid it on Celestine V's tomb. Did he know already in 2009 that he was going to resign? What was that act? It's an interesting moment. But he had to know what Dante's judgment was of that act and the danger that it posed for the church at that time.
Wow, an interesting historical connection there. What can you tell us about Pope Francis? And related to what can you tell us about him, I mean, we're already seeing images of Pope Francis meeting with Pope Emeritus Benedict. And so the question, I mean, what an unusual sight to see, right? These two popes together. It's unheard of. I mean, what are the implications of this? And is Pope Emeritus Benedict going to be involved at all in Pope Francis's tenure as Pope?
Yeah, that scene and the video that it was provided, obviously, by the Vatican, and there's a little video montage of the interaction between Francis and Benedict in Castel Gandolfo, which happened on this last Saturday, is striking, and I would have to say even a little disconcerting, because as you look at the video, when Benedict approaches the Pope, Francis, what do? When you meet the Pope, you kiss his ring. Benedict does not kiss Francis's ring. At least it's not in the video montage we see. They meet as equals. And if anything, Benedict is in charge of the meeting. You see later that they're sitting there reading. Francis is in the visitor's chair. Benedict is in the chair of the desk. I mean, just the optics, as we might say, of that meeting don't work well to show that the new Pope's in charge. You spoke also about Francis's Italian heritage. That has made him a favorite in Italy. They don't see him as an Argentinian. They see him as an Italian who moved to Argentina, if you understand the difference there. They very much identify him as Italian, more so, more European even, in their perspective, than Ratzinger, than Benedict XVI, in the sense that he's one of theirs. He is not an Italian pope, but he's as close as you can get to an Italian pope. And I think that makes a lot of Italians happy, because this immigrant experience of Italian is part of their history, and they identify with it.
So does this bode well then for Pope Francis in terms of his reign? You know, the significant issues he's facing. I mean, there are so many things that he's, you know, faced with today. The challenges that the church is dealing with. Is this, you know, he's being well received. Does this mean that there's a lot of hope for for what he will do for the church?
I think there's hope, but I think that there's the hope that I sense is not institutional hope. What I mean by that is people aren't talking about how he's going to fix the problems of the Curia, and that was Benedict's problem, the administration of the church in Rome. He doesn't seem like a strong character in that sense. He's charismatic. He's going to fix, or Italians believe he's going to fix, that I've spoken to, the image of the church, or even better, or even more specific, the image of the papacy. He's 76, he has one lung. I don't think people imagine him having a long papacy. But
that was the question. I mean, he also is advanced in age and not necessarily, 100% healthy, as has one lung. So the question is, do you think Pope Benedict has set a precedent here that perhaps we'll see future popes resign due to their health or other issues?
I wonder if Benedict meant that. If he's done that, he has changed the papacy in a way no one has since probably the 11th century. That would be an incredible change to the institution of the papacy if there's a precedence to resignation. I don't think it's going to happen. I think Francis will serve out his time until his death, and I think that will continue to be the way the papacy changes hands. And this will stand out as a moment that we'll talk about, or that church historians will talk about for the next 600 years. But if it does change the way that the papacy is elected the office is held, that'll be a radical change that will completely change the office, in my estimation. That's to be seen.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Jason Houston, for joining us on Worldviews and bringing this perspective from Italy and adding an historical flair. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Suzette, for having me. It was a pleasure.
That was Jason Houston speaking with me via Skype from the University of Oklahoma Center in Arezzo, Italy. You can find a link to that video of Pope Emeritus Benedict's meeting with Pope Francis on our website, kgou.org. The University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies produces Worldviews through a partnership with KGOU. Mackenzie Samus prepared the research for this interview, and Brian Hardzinski is our producer and digital content editor. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gralat.